The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McInnes. Hope you're having a nice start to the new year. I looked back at the past year and I grabbed a few interviews that had some of my favorite moments from 2021, and I want to share those with you on the program this morning. There were several interviews where things were said that really impressed me, things that I look back and I think that that's a really cool thing to know, that's a really wonderful story to hear, that kind of thing. So I went back and I pulled out excerpts from three interviews that we did last year. And we're going to start off with one I did with a fellow who lives on a farm in Indiana. His name is Clifford Kindy. And he had written a book, a memoir, called Resurrection Peacemaking, Plowsharing the Tools of War, 30 Years with Christian Peacemaker Teams. Cliff Kindy doesn't just talk the talk. He walks the walk. He doesn't believe we should have wars. Wars are obsolete. He wants peace. And he's willing to put himself into hazardous situations to try to accomplish that goal. And when we were getting ready to invade Iraq under President George W. Bush, almost 20 years ago, Cliff Kindy was down on the ground in Baghdad trying to prevent the war, trying to stop it, trying to stop the bombing. Let's listen now to Clifford Kindy talking about what that was like on the best of the Book Nook.
In February, before the bombing started, we got a call from Dick Cheney's daughter. Dick Cheney was the Vice President of the United States, and she said, I'd like to join you in Baghdad. Well, okay. But before she could get there, Dick Cheney had flown an overnight jet to Amman, Jordan, and talked her out of it. But what if she had been in Baghdad? Well, she's not a really important person. I don't think it was Liz. I don't know who it was, but daughter of Cheney. Then the last delegation from CPT that came in was with Jim Douglas. He had contacts with the cardinals at the Vatican. And they stopped in Rome to see if the Pope would come in with their delegation. What if the Pope had been in Baghdad before the bombers flew? Would that have stopped the war? I mean, start to speculate. What does it take to stop a war? It wasn't like there wasn't huge outcry from around the world, from NATO forces, from the Joint Chiefs of Staff, from most of the populations of our allies, hundreds of millions of people saying, no war. But it happened. One story I'll tell from this. 10 days into the bombing, so we were one of the few internationals in Baghdad. We probably had maybe 50 people in our group there in Baghdad. We were in two different hotels, sort of to up the possibility that some of us might live through it. And 10 days in, an airstrike took out the communication center just a couple blocks from where we were staying. So we couldn't call a taxi to go to our meeting that morning, so we walked over. And on the way, we could see the site, and there was a police officer there in the corner. Okay, if we go and check out this communication center that was bombed. And he said, sure, welcome. But there were other people in Baghdad at that time that weren't quite so excited about people that looked like could be undercover from the United States. We probably looked like people from the United States. Mm-hmm. And so we were picked up and ordered out of the country. And on that journey out of the country, it was 300 miles west of the Jordanian border, but it's through the area that the conflict was hot at that time. So there were U.S. fighter jets in the air, burned-out chassis of trucks and buses along the side of this big highway, bomb craters, bridges that had been hit by missiles. And as we were in Rutpa, we were passing a chassis of a burned-out bus on the right-hand lane. We were in the left lane. My guess is we picked up some shrapnel at that point. And about 4 kilometers down the road, bang, our left rear tire blew, and we were in the ditch, which would have been fine, except at the end of the ditch there was concrete abutment, which stopped us. The other two cars in the caravan went on, didn't look back for another half an hour, and they were at the Jordanian border, but we were there by ourselves. All of us injured in the accident, but all still living. We clambered out of the vehicle, and an eastbound Iraqi hollered across the median, "Can I help you?" He loaded us into his vehicle, took us back into Rutpa, the only population center in the western desert. And there, medical personnel, first aid people, put us up on tables. This was after 12 years of sanctions, so the medical system was pretty much in shambles, no painkillers and anything like that. And I was the last one. I think they were doing triage, trying to save the easiest ones first. I clamped my hat to my head to staunch the flow of blood. I had a cut in the shape in the top of my head, kind of like the shape of a dome light, because we didn't have seat belts. And I was still awake, and they had explained that it didn't matter whether we were Iraqi or American, they'd take care of us. Didn't matter whether we were Muslim or Christian, they'd take care of us. And as the doctor was sewing up my head, he said, "You know, 3 days ago, a U.S. pilot bombed and destroyed my children's hospital here in Rutpa." And I realized at that point that I was the enemy. I was from the same country as the fighter jet that has taken out his hospital. And I'm alive today because my enemy was willing to sew me back up. Sort of a Good Samaritan story. Hmm. But it's... And that's what... That's the kind of hospitality that we found in Iraq. Later on, as house raids and things went on, more and more resistance built up against the United States, and they were starting to say, well, what we had under Saddam was much better than what we have under Bush. And at that point, anybody that looked like us was beginning to be targeted. Anybody who worked with us began to be targeted. But that story, I mean, the Good Samaritan story, and I wasn't the Good Samaritan.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, making radio with the community and for the community. And this morning on the Book Nook, I'm bringing you some excerpts from some of my favorite interviews from the year that just ended, 2021. And that was Clifford Kindy, who lives on a farm in Indiana, talking about what it was like to be there in Baghdad, in Iraq, as the war was beginning, and he was trying to stop it. And the name of his book is Resurrection Peacemaking, Plowsharing the Tools of War, 30 years with Christian peacemaker teams. He's traveled all over the world trying to defuse conflicts. In fact, he's banned from Israel. They won't let him in the country because of what he's tried to do to stop the conflicts between Palestinians and Israelis. And he's just an amazing guy, and I hope his publisher, a very small publisher out in the Pacific Northwest, submits that book to be judged for the Dayton Literary Peace Prize this year, because I think it's so powerful. The message of peace is so incredible in that book that I really think it would be a contender for the prize, and I would love to hear Cliff Kindy come to Dayton, Ohio, and give a speech about it. He's well-known in Dayton. He's spent a lot of time here in this community. Comes over from Indiana. And we're going to continue now with some of my favorite excerpts from the past year. Ian Rankin has made a number of appearances on the program over the years, 8 or 9 appearances. And the most unusual one took place last year when we talked about a book that he finished, a book that was started by another writer who he admired named William McIlvanney. And he had written notes for this novel, The Dark Remains, Laidlaw's First Case, and then he died before he could finish it. And Ian Rankin went in and finished the book. And during our conversation about it, Ian, who is best known for his Inspector Rebus series, mentioned that he is considering possibly writing some prequels featuring John Rebus. Now, he's never considered doing this before, but after he worked on this project, the Laidlaw project, he thought about it because Rebus isn't getting any younger. He ages in real time. And in the last few books, his health has been poor. He's had less of a place in the books. The other police are solving the cases. He's just kind of sitting back, and you're thinking, we need a flashback. We need to go to the young John Rebus. And now Ian Rankin is considering that. Let's hear what he said.
There's a possibility in future books that, you know, that young Laidlaw and young Rebus might be able to meet. Who knows?
Oh, so you're hinting that Rebus, who's getting a bit long in the tooth, there might be a prequel on the way for Rebus, who is getting a little bit old, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I mean, you know this because you've spoke to me before. I've always been very resistant to the idea of going back to the early days of Rebus because there would be historical novels and I wasn't sure I could do it. But this book has persuaded me that if I did want to go down that path, I could do it. I could write an early Rebus book. It would be set in not the 70s, but the 80s. But the potential is there in the future if I get a really great idea or run out of things to do with the Rebus in the present day, and that's not happened yet. But if it did happen, there's the feasibility that I could take Rebus back in time, and I didn't think that was possible before I wrote this book.
I would love to see that, and I've got to note that some of my favorite Lee Child books are the prequels, just because you find out something about these people. You find out who they are, and I love that. Now, if I had to pick a favorite of these three Laidlaw books that he wrote, I would say the second one, The Papers of Tony Veitch. And the reason why I say that is because in this book, he shows us how much he cares about what is right and about being a good person. And even though his personal life is a mess and he's got a terrible drinking problem and he's violent, he's really just got a heart. And he wants to find the truth. And that was so powerful for me.
Yeah, literary critics have called William McIlvany the Scottish Camus, as in Albert Camus, French novelist and philosopher. And there's something of that kind of existentialism. There's something of that that his character Laidlaw has a set of rules that he lives by, and he's very loath to break any of those rules. And he is always seeking justice. He is always seeking closure for victims. He is always seeking to bring order from chaos. But the world around him sometimes has other ideas. So he's very much in that, you know, I mean, we know that people like Philip Marlowe, Chandler's character, are in that mold as well, trying to bring order from chaos in a disordered world. There's definitely something of that. I just think Laidlaw is a great character. He's someone you want to hang around with. He's someone you'd be proud to know. And having met William McIlvany many times and been for a drink with him in Glasgow and elsewhere, they share so much. There's an awful lot of the character of Laidlaw in McIlvany. But also, I think there's something of the gangster figure, John Rhodes. There are several gangsters in the series, but John Rhodes, I think, who was a huge influence on my gangster, Big Jer Cafferty, I think McIlvany was a little bit in love with John Rhodes because he gets more screen time than anybody else, and there's much more empathy there, and there's an empathetic relationship between him and Laidlaw that isn't there between Laidlaw and any of the other gangsters he comes up against.
That was Ian Rankin. I spoke to him in September last year, talking about The Dark Remains, Laidlaw's first case, a book written by William McIlvany that he never finished, and Ian Rankin completed it for him, and that helped Ian
possibly decide that he's going to write some prequels with his character John Rebus. We'll just have to wait and see. But that's the first I heard about it during that interview, and I'm very excited to think about a young John Rebus making appearances in future books by Ian Rankin. We've got just enough time for one more excerpt, and we're going to go to an interview that I did with James Lee Burke. This is my 20th interview with Jim. I talked to him for his novel, Another Kind of Eden, and it was a very different kind of interview. Here's James Lee Burke talking about the time he saw Dwight Eisenhower twice in one day.
Mike Eisenhower was a great man. You know, he waved to me twice in one day in London in August of 1959. Huh. That's a fact. I was standing, I was a graduate student at the time, and I was standing in front of St. Paul's Cathedral, just a tourist, and this open Rolls Royce, it was a Rolls Royce with no type, top, pulled in right beside me with Dwight Eisenhower and Prime Minister McMillan in the back seat. And Ike was standing up, and there was a pub on the other side of the street. It was midday, and people, you could hear this gasp. And all of these working men came out of the pub, and one of them was plastered out of his head, and he came right for Eisenhower. And Ike raised his hands and then stretched out and held the man's hands, both hands, and the drunk man said, "Ike, I was there with you at Sword Beach. We whipped Jerry's ass, didn't we?" And Ike said, "How you doing there, Tommy?" and shook both of his hands. Prime Minister McMillan looked like sewer gas had been released in his face. He looked horrified. The difference between the patrician and Ike, the man of the people. Anyway, that was midday. That same day, later on that night, I went to see the West Side Story in Piccadilly, and after the play, I was walking home to St. James Plaza. There was nobody on the street. Here came that same Dad Byrne Rolls Royce again, but the top was on it. Ike's back window was down. Nobody else was on the street, and I waved my hand, and he stuck his hand and his whole shoulder out the window and waved to me. What are the odds of that happening twice in one day with no planning? I didn't even know Eisenhower was visiting the city.
Oh, I never heard that story before, Jim.
It's a great story, and I'll never forget it. But the thing is, golly, Moses, it just that was Ike Eisenhower, though. He was always called the soldier, you know, because he was a very decent and good man.
I remember he was asked one time what he thought about his vice president's work, what he thought Dick Nixon had done, and to paraphrase, he said something like, "Well, if you give me a while," he says, "maybe I can think of something."
No, I said a week. He said, "Give me a week and I'll get back to you." He hated Nixon.
Right.
Tried not to use his name.
Yeah. Well, you have his name in your book, Another Kind of Eden. There, his picture is on the wall in somebody's place.
Is it?
Yeah.
I forget that scene. It's not a good, it's not complimentary.
Yeah. Right. Strom Thurmond.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Nixon, Billy Graham, and Strom Thurmond are hanging in this man's house.
Right. Yeah. That's it.
I had breakfast with Strom Thurmond.
Uh-huh.
That's a fact, 1981. The man was just crazy as a blue jay in a mulberry tree.
Yeah. And now... Speaking of villains, Jim, you have some great villains, as always, in your new novel, Another Kind of Eden, but I sure do miss Smiley. Are we ever going to see Smiley again? You never actually killed him off, did you?
Well, Smiley is one of these guys that has a way of coming back.
Okay. All right.
He is the best villain I've ever created.
Okay.
I love Smiley. In fact, we were going to make Smiley buttons.
Right.
And with a smiley face, but with the caption underneath, Smiley is coming to your city soon.
Right. I would love to have one of those.
Oh, geez, he's a great character.
Now, Jim, if you had to give our listeners just a brief capsule, what is Another Kind of Eden about? What is the story about?
It's about today. It's not about 1962. You remember what Faulkner said, the past is not the past. It's not even the past. That, in effect, this is my view, the changes of the country, the big ones that have, for good or bad, marked the era in which we live today, had their inception with the year 1962.
Oh.
So in this book, we see the beginnings of the drug culture, this bus full of what people call beatniks back then. But this bus arrives, and of course, there's some really insidious people on board. Most of them are victims, but they're the orphans of America who made up the Charles Manson family. But Manson, this Manson story is not about Manson. It's about America.
Mm.
You know, and Haight-Ashbury is just a giant open-air orphanage. But secondly, it's about the class war, and we're still involved in it. We're in the heart of it. Another idea, I think, in this book, and it's not actually anything that I came up with, I think it's obvious, is the fact we are still involved with the American Civil War. It's still here. It's still going. The same engines are at work, the same people, the same economics.
Mm.
And also the war between the states had its inception with the what was called the Native or Know Nothing Party of the 1830s.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where we are today, except more frighteningly, because it's not geographical anymore. It's ideological, and it's from coast to coast. It's here. It's real. There are a large number of self-benighted people who are willing to turn over their common sense, their rationality, and put their lives, their destiny, everything that is dear to them in the hands of iniquitous men.
Mm. Okay. Well,
that's it.
I
had breakfast with Strom Thurmond.
Mm-hmm.
I did so as penance because I sold barbecue tickets for him in 1948 door to door for a political rally. I was only 11 years old, but I still felt guilty. And so I went to this breakfast for him at a university where I was teaching. And this is 1981 when Senator Thurmond, you know, he sent four men to the electric chair. One was a 17-year-old black kid who may have acted in self-defense. But anyway, he was the symbol of segregation. He also was the man who forced Nixon to put Agnew on the ticket.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he was sitting not just very close to me, and he seemed he was also the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He was a very powerful man. Now, you are a journalist, and I have worked as a journalist as well. And I've always believed that the Antichrist is out there somewhere in the form of a politician. Well, as we both have discovered, when we expect to meet Satan, we end up talking to Elmer Fudd. It's like talking to an empty closet with moss in it. Anyway, Senator Thurmond was criticizing, at least as I remember, people who were on welfare and the media and welfare. This I'm shocked that he would talk about media and welfare people.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so this is a literal quote. Okay, ready?
Yeah.
Why the media, they're obsessive. When John Kennedy was killed, that's all they talked about for days. For days. That's a literal quote. I turned this man next to me and I said, did he just say that? And my friend next to me said, yep, he sure did. This is what I mean. They say, you don't get Machiavelli, you get Bugs Bunny.
That was a man who has made more appearances on this program than any other guest, James Lee Burke. That was my 20th interview with Jim, and we talked about his most recent novel, Another Kind of Eden. And that was a very different interview than previous ones. For one thing, usually during an interview, he will say, regarding the book that we're discussing in that particular interview, that this is the best book I've ever written. Well, during this interview, he never said that, and he didn't really seem to want to talk about the book. He wanted to tell stories. He told that incredible story about seeing Dwight Eisenhower twice in one day in London, and then he segued into his story about sitting at a table with Senator Strom Thurmond and what a strange experience that was, and talking about Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd, and he did a vocal imitation of Strom Thurmond. And in all the years that I've interviewed Jim, he's never told the Eisenhower story in any of the previous interviews. He's talked about Strom Thurmond, but he never got into so much detail. And he really wanted to tell stories during that interview. And he's in his mid-80s now. That book was a little thinner, a few fewer pages than he normally produces. And I have to wonder, are we getting near the end of the writing road for this wonderful novelist, one of my favorites? Will I ever get to interview him again? I've wondered that the last several times I've talked to him, whether this was the last one. And there was a real feeling of finality in this particular conversation. He isn't getting any younger, and his beloved wife of more than half a century has been in poor health, and I think this is affecting him. And I dread the day when I won't be able to do another interview with James Lee Burke, because he is so funny, and he's such a great writer. And when you hear him laugh, he has the most infectious laughter. His daughter, Allifair, told me a story one time that they were in their Catholic church and he started laughing during the sermon and suddenly everyone around was laughing too. What a great man. For the Best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis.